Well, as Bob Zimmerman writes, the Apollo program was an amazing achievement. It was hard, and we did it. In fact, it was so hard that no one has ever come close to doing it again. But why? Let's find out. Let's take your final calls for the hour when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Bob, why are we so far ahead of everybody? I mean, we went to the moon in 1969. I mean, here we are, 40 years later. Nobody else has done this.
Yeah.
Lack of interest, lack of money, or lack of brain power?
We were so far ahead of everybody else in the 60s, George, because of the nation that we were at that time. This was a space race between the Soviet Union, which was a state-run, state-owned, centralized command.
And they did a pretty good job.
Well, yes, but it cost them, and they didn't have the depth of a society that a free society gives you. And we went to the moon. I mean, Kennedy said it. We stand for freedom. No friend, no neutral, and no adversary should think otherwise. We are not against any man or any nation or any system except as it is hostile to freedom. That's what we stood for then. And the freedom that this nation had, it wasn't the government doing things, as Kennedy said. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. You didn't ask the government to run things or solve your problems. Everyone assumed the government would stay out of our lives and we'd be free. What that produced was a nation with extremely a depth of resources and abilities and capabilities. Everyone contributed their own personal achievement and just as in their normal lives. And when suddenly the call came out to do something grand, the nation could rise up and do it because the depth of resources were there. This same thing happened in World War II. I mean, we came out of nowhere in World War II, and in less than 4 years, we beat Germany. The Russians helped. The British helped, but the truth of the matter is it was done by the United States, and for the same reason, freedom. So that's what put us ahead of everybody else. The sad thing to me about the 60s space race is that Kennedy sent us to the moon to prove that free society could do it better. But he did it as a government program. And it has, unfortunately, its legacy over the decades has been to teach later generations of Americans that government programs are the way to do things. And that is the nation we live in today. We are more like the Soviet Union than we are the nation of 1960 America. And we look to the government to solve our problems continuously, and we look to the government to run our space program. And the way we really would succeed best, I think, is not to look in that direction. But that is one of the legacies of the Apollo NASA program in the 60s, to teach us to look for the government to solve these problems.
And you think that was wrong?
This is a sad, it's a sad consequence. I mean, human beings are imperfect. We were in a Cold War in the 60s, and we could not let the Russians beat us to space. We had to compete, and at the time, government might have been the only way, was apparently the only way to compete. But the unintended consequence of that is it taught generations of Americans to look to the government for the solving of all problems. And in the end, those problems can't be solved by the government. All problems, all personal problems, you have to solve them yourself. You're personally responsible. And the government can never solve them. And usually what happens when the government tries to get involved is it doesn't do it very well. And that definitely applies to NASA. NASA, in its first decade, it depended mostly on the private sector to get things accomplished. There was a resource there, and NASA mined that resource. But in the later decades, NASA stopped mining that resource. It became the be-end and do-all. And so that it hasn't been very innovative. It has not been able to accomplish very much in the last 40 years, sadly enough. Part of that is not necessarily NASA's fault. Part of it is a government agency. It must get approval from politicians. You have, therefore, the political shenanigans that always go on. As they say, making a law is worse than making sausage. You don't want to see how it's done. Well, anytime you're depending on government financing to get anything accomplished, it's going to make things hard and difficult. My book on Hubble, The Universe in a Mirror, it's an incredible story of a 40-year epic tale of some visionaries wanting to build a space telescope because, you know, the atmosphere is fuzzy and your astronomers are limited by that atmosphere, and you get a telescope in space, you're going to see wonders beyond belief. And they had a struggle for 40 years, and much of that struggle was trying to get money from the government and dealing with the government political and the bureaucratic labyrinth that exists by nature when you depend on big science or big projects within the government framework. So, yes, I think it's unfortunate, George.
How come we don't hear much about the Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico?
Arecibo does a great deal of research. Its number one thing right now is it works with SETI, looking for signals from other life forms.
Right. But, I mean, that's a huge radio telescope.
Yes, it is. It's an interesting, I don't know the whole political story behind that, but there was a period of time where it was threatened to close. And I think they've received some funding. I don't think it's a government operation, and that's part of its problem.
Who owns it, do you know?
No, actually, I'm not. I haven't actually, I've seen the reports on it, and it's one of these things, I got to look into that. But I've never gotten around to doing it, so I can't give you any more details. I know it was threatened to close. It has stayed open, and it does research. But it doesn't do, I have not seen, astronomers don't appear to use it as much as I would think they should. And there might be some technical reason that I'm not aware of. So I can't answer the question, unfortunately.
Okay, let's go to Drew, first-time caller, driving around in New Mexico. Hi, Drew.
Hey, guys, how's it going?
Okay.
Hey, Bob, I just wanted to hear your opinion on intelligent design. And if I could just tell you the argument that swayed me. If one was to walk along the beach and find a watch and never had seen a watch before, would one really think that something that watch just came out of nowhere, or that somebody, a higher intelligence or something like that, created that? And I just wanted to hear your opinion of all the things that you've seen, if you think that there's something else out there that, you know, above us that, you know, made all these things that actually have a purpose and all come in line for one thing.
Drew, that is a spectacularly good question. And I will have to tell you that some people might call me a godless secular humanist, and in many ways I am. But I also have to tell you that I do not dismiss intelligent design at all. Because, as I said earlier in the show, you know, they say about, you know, put a million monkeys in front of a million typewriters and they'll eventually write Shakespeare, but no one's ever seen that happen. It doesn't happen randomly. So I do not dismiss intelligent design. And in fact, I find most of the intellectual community's attitude towards this concept to be offensive, their hostility to it to be offensive. Because if you have an open mind, and that's what science requires, then you can't dismiss it. You have to at least factor it into your equation. It might not be true. It very well might be true, but I absolutely respect it as a possibility. I like to, you know, I have in one of my talks, one of the images I use is a shot of a lunar rover with some astronauts on the moon, and there's the horizon, and you see this black sky. Well, what's behind the black sky? We're always looking to try to delve into that black sky. And Hubble gave us a glimpse of what's out there. And our planetary probes have given us a better glimpse of some of the nearer objects out there. But what's out there, we don't know. And could there be a God out there? It very well be. And so I absolutely do not dismiss it in any way, shape, or form. And I repeat, I find it very offensive that much of the intellectual community today is very hostile to even discussing it. And that's too bad.
I found out who owns the Arecibo telescope.
Okay.
The folks at thenighthawkzone.com, they own it. You own it. I own it. Every listener owns it. The U.S. government owns it.
It does own it.
But it doesn't fund it all. It reduced its funding from $10 million to $4 million, maybe even less. And now the Puerto Rican government's trying to kick in some cash.
All right. You're getting the details of something I had seen but didn't remember the specifics. I knew that their funding was cut and they were threatened to close. And so I know they teamed up with SETI, and that might be one of the ways they're trying to make up the shortfall in cash.
Absolutely. Let's go next. Devil's Lake, North Dakota. Hello, David. It's your turn. Go ahead.
I'm George, and Robert, pleasure to talk to you. I share your enthusiasm about Apollo. I was have been an amateur astronomer since the days of Sputnik, which dates me a little bit, I suppose. Two amateur astronomy buddies and I went to Florida, rented a motel room in Titusville, and watched Apollo 11 leave the Earth. Thought it was pretty momentous, and I still feel that way about it. you know, the moon being the easiest extraterrestrial object to see, it's hard not to look up at it and think, hey, you know, we've been there. There's footprints there and stuff. So pretty cool. I can tell you a little bit more about Arecibo. It's the dish for that telescope is built into the ground, so right. It's not highly steerable. That's one of the limitations that it right. has. I wanted to make two other comments. One of them is, there's so much a person could say in our lifetimes alone that we've learned about the cosmos and where we live and stuff like that. Earlier, your guest mentioned galaxies, and as you might know, within the last century, we weren't sure that there was even more than one galaxy.
Yes.
That was thought to be the entire universe, and of course now, as has been said, we know there are lots of them.
Yes.
So that's just one example of all the amazing stuff that we've learned. And then I wanted to go back to the earlier comment, because I agree it's kind of a touchstone about, is there other life out there? And, you know, science in a very constructive way is an inherently conservative thing. You know, if you got the facts and the evidence, then they'll buy it. And we don't have that yet, like your guest has been talking about,
right.
The monkeys and the typewriters. Well, we don't have that kind of evidence, but let's remember Albert Einstein, who did a little science himself, mentioned that, believed, I think strongly, in fact, that imagination is as important as knowledge and intelligence. And I think as we learn more and more about how planets are formed and the chemistry that seems to be replete throughout the universe, even places where there aren't planets, it's kind of hard to imagine that there isn't life out there. Now, I don't know that we've found evidence of it yet, and George and I might disagree with that on that a little bit, but I think there's so many planets, and it just seems to me to be wildly improbable that there couldn't be life. And let me just throw in one other thing. I remember years ago reading the idea that carbon, we talk about life as we know it, which would be based on carbon, and carbon to form the long molecules that creates our life is not stable at real high temperatures, but other materials, and I think silicon is the one that I read about,
yes.
can do that. So we don't, even though science is going to inherently say, let's talk about life as we know it, because that is all we know, there are other possibilities for life beyond, even within the chemical realm, beyond carbon-based life forms, to borrow the Star Trek term.
Scientists are going to be, good science, you have to be careful. You cannot assume there's life out there until you actually find it. So that scientists are going to take that approach, and I agree with it. I don't like to speculate or opinionate too far in advance, but I agree with you. Well, just simply looking at Earth alone, the incredible range of extreme environments in which we find life. As I was reading today in a science paper, the Earth is literally saturated with life. You can't go anywhere without finding it. And in sometimes extremely deadly environments, high temperatures, cold temperatures, high pressure, low pressure, it's everywhere. So yes, just on that premise alone, it seems highly improbable that there won't be life elsewhere. But until we find it, we don't know. And we have to be careful. If we start to assume there's going to be life there, we might take the data and make believe it, twist it into being life before it really we really know that fact. We have to really look at the data very coldly before we come to any conclusions. That's my main thing. I don't like to jump to conclusions, and I think every scientist would agree with me on that. It's dangerous when you do that.
Okay, West Hartford, Connecticut. Good morning, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi. Dr. Zimmerman. Hi, this is Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut.
Hey, Bill. I'm not a doctor. I've never got a PhD, just a master's, but that's okay. Go ahead,
okay.
Bill.
Let me tell you, you mentioned you're a non-religious person. I'm an atheist and a secular humanist myself. I say that for a reason, because there are two missions that I think will change the paradigm against religion and myth, and religion to me is all myth, and the scientific method and science, and especially space science and reality, is the way to go. And those two missions, the first one was mentioned in the May issue of Sky and Telescope magazine, titled Planck will be ready to dissect the Big Bang. Planck, which is the cosmic microwave background explorer to explore the microwave energy left over from the Big Bang. And the other one is Kepler, that will look for other Earth-sized planets, hopefully in the habitable zones of their stars. What I'm saying is, instead of the beliefs in Genesis and God and the universe, Planck may prove out the multiverse, the infinite series of universes. For example, if Planck detects gravity waves in the background microwave radiation, it may not only tell us what happened before the Big Bang, but if there are other universes. And I don't know of any religious book at all, the Bible, the Quran, or anyone that talks about universes, plural, infinite universes, the multiverse. So the multiverse may be reality, totally anathema and opposite to insane, crazy religions, in my opinion.
Bill, there's one issue here that we have to remember in discussing religion and science, and that they are two different things. Religion is philosophy. It is about the why of the universe. Science and research is about the how of the universe, the what of the universe. They are different things, and they're very important to keep that distinction in mind. When you talk about researching what the universe is and how it functions, science gives us the ability to understand that better every day. We get a better idea of what the universe is like. But that does not preclude philosophical discussions of any kind in any respect. Many religions, which might have their mythologies, don't have a problem if those mythologies are proved to be mythology in terms of their philosophical approach to God and existence. And I speak here as an open-minded individual who just simply, I'm not hostile to those belief systems because they cannot be disproven in terms of science, even in the context of multi-universes, they can't. Because the why question science doesn't address. Why is this here? Why was it formed that way? Science can't answer that question. And so the only answer to that question can come from philosophical belief. And this is where liberty of conscience comes in once again. Each of us has to go to our soul and find out what we believe. And that's where I come from.
Are you happy with the progress of the International Space Station?
No, I'm very frustrated. I've always been very frustrated with the International Space Station, George. I mean, as I said in leaving Earth, you go up there. The whole point of this is to try to figure out how to build an interplanetary spaceship so we can start exploring the planets. And NASA, we designed it faultily, so we can't do that as effectively as we'd like. And secondly, NASA's afraid to go ahead and do it anyway. I mean, we should be having multi-year expeditions up there with crews staying there for long periods of time. The only way we're going to start to learn how to do this. You know, recently there are these ground-based missions on Earth where guys are going into a facility to duplicate a Mars mission for several months. Well, why not do that on ISS? It's a much better simulation. You're in weightlessness. But NASA doesn't want to do it and has not moved forward, and so it kind of just sits there. And it's extremely frustrating to me. It's like we spent a lot of money to build this, and this is a facility that is perfect for doing this research to learn how to get to other planets, and we're not doing it.
Okay, next up, let's go to, we'll get a quick question in before the break, Johnson City, Tennessee. Jeremy, go ahead.
George, how you doing this morning?
Good, Jeremy.
Good morning, Jeremy.
All right. Well, I've got a couple of questions about, like your last caller, I guess probably the last one or maybe a couple before me there. Where he said he was an atheist. Now, I don't understand, I understand what that means. Robert, you're right with, science and religion having two different things there. I think it basically took, 7 days or so to make the Earth and things of that nature. So that was, to me, there's not a Big Bang theory as far as that goes. As far as the space program and things of that nature go, to sail off of religion because it's a totally different subject. I remember in fourth grade.
And hold it right there. We'll be back with you, Jeremy, when we come back. Well, they call themselves the Web Bots, and George Urie and Cliff will be our guests on our next Coast to Coast show, talking about some future events that affect all of us. When we come back, let's take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we've got Bob Zimmerman, final calls. Let's go back to Jeremy in Johnson City, Tennessee. All right, Jeremy, you were saying that you were in the fourth grade.
Yeah, and I'm thinking it was the Challenger disaster in 1986. Like you were saying earlier in the program, which is that probably toward the very start of the program, around the 1 or 2 o'clock hour, where you guys remembered, you know, coming into class and having those the TVs on the big roller cart stuff, you know. That's kind of what ours was, and you know, the teachers rolled them in there and showed us what was going on. We watched the countdown, and then the liftoff. Well, everything was looked like everything was going to go okay from Cape Canaveral, but then all of a sudden you had this big explosion, and I remember that quite well, just for the simple reason that that was the big one that was supposed to have the first teacher in space. Her name was Krista McAuliffe, and
yeah,
I don't remember.
That's right.
I don't remember the rest of the shuttle crew other than her. But that kind of had a big impact on me and things of that nature. I really don't have that big of a question or maybe any other question at all, other than just to, you know,
a little space observation. Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah. That was a horrible moment.
Yeah, and you know, it was. Jeremy describes almost every school kid in the United States in 86 was sitting there watching because it was the first teacher in space.
Yeah, everybody was. They were all excited.
Yeah, and here you have every kid in the United States seeing the shuttle blow up. When I was teaching film in New York about 15 years ago, I actually was struck. This is before I got into science writing. But I was struck, but I was passionately interested in space still. I was struck by the students that came in that I thought would have been school kids around the time of the Challenger accident. There seems to be like, they seemed to go through like a, there was a class that seemed almost depressed. And I could, I have no idea if this is connected at all, but that was, I can't imagine what that must have been like for the kids. I just can't.
The shuttle astronauts, Commander Francis Scooby, Pilot Michael Smith, Krista McAuliffe, the first teacher, Ellison Onizuka, Judith Resnick, Ronald E. McNair, and then Gregory Jarvis.
Yeah. Yep. There have been, we've had deaths in space. We will have more deaths in space. I guess that's another prediction I can make that's
sadly true.
Absolutely going to happen. But, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon I have noticed over the years. Before the Challenger accident, everyone I knew who was involved in space activism would say, oh, we can't have an accident. If we have an accident, it'll kill the space program. The Challenger blows up. And not only does it not kill the space program, but there's a renewed vigor to replace it with Endeavour and to keep the program going. And then years pass, and then there's fear that if we have another accident, it'll kill the space program, and Columbia crashes, breaks apart as it's coming down and doesn't kill the space program. If anything, there's a renewed spirit. We must move on. And the fact is that as human beings, we recognize that the people who go into space are willing to make the sacrifice to die for the sake of human beings spreading our abilities beyond the Earth. And we all recognize deep down that we will only make those sacrifices a sacrifice in vain if we don't continue. And their very willingness to make that sacrifice forces us to go on.
You know, Richard Nixon had a backup speech ready in case Armstrong and Aldrin got stuck on the moon and couldn't get back.
Yeah, well, he's got to prepare for these kind of conditions.
You've got to be ready for that.
That's right. You have to. I mean, his...
Never had to use it.
Never had to use it. And, you know, it's similarly in Apollo 8. All three astronauts wrote up letters, which they sealed in envelopes, and they gave to their wives and said, don't open this unless something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then they destroyed those letters when they got home. Because, you know, you have to be prepared.
Sure.
I mean, that's part of being honest with yourself and doing things the best way possible. But should something go wrong, the best way to respond is to get back on that horse and do it better.
Why do you think the Soviets at the time, even though we beat them there, stopped?
Well, they part of their problem was that they didn't have a very... Their society was very shallow in terms of its resources and capabilities technologically. It was a commands economy, and therefore when you've got that kind of thing, it's not competitive. You don't have a lot of depth. And so they never had the capability of building a lunar lander. So the best they could do to compete with us is to put a spacecraft with people in it and circle the moon and not even go into orbit around the moon, just zip past the moon and come back to Earth. But once again, being a government operation, they actually had to deal with government political battles. Office politics is another way to put it. They had a variety of different government agencies doing space stuff, and they were competing with each other, but not the kind of competition that private enterprise has, but the kind of – they were fighting for government dollars, and they were backbiting with each other. And that ended up making the program less efficient and not effective. And when we finally did orbit Apollo 8, there was no point for them to continue their program because their whole point from the beginning was a government propaganda ploy. And once they had lost the race. So within a year, Brezhnev, the head of Soviet Union at the time, announced that their goal had always been to build space stations because they were looking for some other way to have a propaganda ploy.
Right, exactly. You know, but, and I had a story where they tried to send the Luna 15 there, scoop up some moon rock, and come on back. But it crashed.
Yeah, they actually launched an unmanned probe to land on the moon and come back with a sample just before Apollo 11.
In the same area that we were headed.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was the same area of the planet, the moon.
Yeah, but it was close to the Sea of Tranquility.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the distances are still large, you know.
True.
But either way, the point is they were trying to get a sample back before us. But that vehicle crashed. I think actually their unmanned Luna probe program was actually quite impressive. They did eventually have an unmanned probe go to the moon, get a sample, and bring it back to Earth. And that's – no other nation to this day has brought – well, we've done it with Stardust, but going to an actual landing on another body
– and leave again, yeah.
We haven't – no one's done it but them.
Quartzsite, Arizona, Alan, west of the Rockies. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Good morning, you both.
Morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations, George. What a fantastic show on the 40th anniversary of the Moon Month. Absolutely fantastic.
You're welcome. Good. Our staff put it together.
Well, thank you very much.
Bob, thank you so much for spending so much time with us tonight. Bob, I'd like to ask you, have you got any idea what the Air Force and NASA have going on at North Edwards Air Force Base?
I'm not sure. You'd have to be more specific. I mean, Edwards Air Force Base is used for a lot of flight testing, has for decades. It's used as a backup landing site for the shuttle. So you have to be more specific about your question. I'm not sure what you're asking.
About 12 years ago, I was traveling down southbound US 395, probably about 15 miles away from that facility. 2 o'clock in the morning, a moonless, cloudless sky. All of a sudden, 20-30% of the entire southern sky was illuminated in brilliant white. And it got to the point where I started craning my neck out the windshield to just wondering what was going on. And all of a sudden, a cylindrical object came off the ground in my direction, traveling. I couldn't even begin to guess, thousands of miles an hour. No contrail at all, none. Ran this story by a friend of mine, a Fulbright colonel, about 10 years ago, and he blurted out, "Oh, sure, that's project's been around since about 1969. I said, "Great, tell me more."
Yeah.
And he clammed up. It was like he'd realized, "Oh, I've said too much here." And if you knew the colonel like I did, you didn't press him if he didn't want to talk about anything. That's how specific I'm getting. One of the callers about an hour ago was talking about the dual space program. I can't think of a better example. What are they doing over there? And that was 12 years ago.
Well, all right. When you, the description you describe of what you say you saw, my first thought was it could be a test firing of an engine, which would be extremely bright. Of course, one has to ask oneself, if one is doing a secret program, the last thing you should do is do that at night because it's going to be visible from a long way away. So I'm not sure. Depending on the date in which you saw this, it could have been something NASA was doing their own research engine tests. I'm not sure they do engine tests at Edwards. They usually do that at Stennis down in Alabama. So I can't answer your question. I'm not sure what that could be.
Okay. Next up, a couple more calls, and we're wrapping things up here. Marcus in Fresno, California. Go ahead, Marcus.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hey.
Hey.
George and the visitor there, calling out of Fresno. There's one thing that I have to say, and that is before we start trying to figure out what's going on in space and all that real complex issues, we have to figure out what's going on here. I don't know if you guys are familiar with, there's a guy who came out, and his name is Chris Angel. Have you heard of him before?
Well, yeah, the illusionist.
Yes, and he works with a lot of different things. He works with kinetic energy. He's done so many different demonstrations with levitating, walking through walls, and all the stuff that he does. He's doing this stuff live on the streets or it's in front of people. It's not staged, no props. And
he's good.
If we can't even figure out, you know, how he does all this stuff, and he's doing this here, how are we going to figure out what's going on in space, and how are we going to figure out all that stuff over there? If he can vanish and disappear and reappear right there in front of your eyes, I mean, and he's working, and I mentioned that he talked about, he said something.
All right, but
about,
so he's a good illusionist. What does that have to do with the space program? What do you think, Bob?
Well, you know, the caller started out by saying, you know, we have issues here on Earth rather than dealing with space, and I'm not sure that's where he ended up going. I always like to say that we don't put the money that they spend in space in the capsule, fire it up there, and it burns up in the atmosphere. It all gets spent here on Earth in the end. Space program is an audience member in one of my talks at a science fiction convention once said something to me incredibly wise. He said, "Science teaches us about the universe. Engineering makes our lives better." And the space program, in many ways, is an engineering research program. It teaches us how to build things better. And the consequences of that is it percolates through the society and makes our lives better in some way or another, because all the research done for the space program is done on Earth by engineers and research people who then say, "Ooh, that's a great idea. I think I'm going to try to make money on that." For example, infrared sensors. You don't touch a door anymore when you go into a supermarket. Well, that's from the space program. LEDs, space program. They were trying to come up with a small, efficient light they can use to grow plants on the shuttle, and that was LEDs. But, I mean, you know, those are just spin-offs. Space will improve our lives. There's no question of that. That's one of the benefits of it. It makes us smarter and quicker. Now, in terms of a magician, I mean, you know, what did Arthur Clarke say? Any science sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. So if we go into space and do it really well, we'll be doing magic far better than any illusionist you can think of.
Indeed, indeed. Jonathan in Atlanta, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning. Rob, you should go on YouTube. Maybe you can find some footage of Gordon Cooper talking about his UFO encounters. They're truly astounding stories he tells.
Yeah, absolutely.
Edgar Mitchell, too, maybe some former coast visits he's had talking about the subject, which is, and me, I've been listening to the coast for almost 13 years, and I'm a real skeptical kind of guy, but I am totally convinced, Robert, that we are being visited by beings from elsewhere. But having said that, talking about the 40th anniversary of our trip to the moon, I grew up in Orlando, Florida. I was 6 years old. When my father took me to the Cape, we were from a second balcony hotel. I saw the rocket blast off from like 3 miles away. I was 6 years old, and it completely shaped my worldview since, that along with Star Trek back then. But it was an amazing thing as a six-year-old kid watching Apollo 11 blast off. I mean, to me, it looked like the Empire State Building taking off into space.
It was.
The whole experience back then was amazing. But my question is about Hubble. I heard another scientist on Coast recently talk about the newly refitted Hubble. could analyze these gases that have been found in the atmosphere of Mars and determine, I guess through the isotopes, whether they're actually organic or inorganic. And an interesting comment also about what you were saying about the sunspot cycle and how completely mysterious it is. Now, I can't see any causative effect in this interesting information, but about the end of the last ice age is when the great storm on Jupiter began. And also, Jupiter has an 11-year orbit around the sun. Now, I can't see any causative factor between Jupiter and the sun and the sunspot cycle, but it is kind of interesting. And lately, I think the spot on Jupiter, the storm, the great red spot, has been changing.
It's changing dramatically.
It's shrinking.
Yeah.
It's a storm that's dying. A
few minutes to go, Bob. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I mean, you know, I have to say that the caller is extremely lucky. I actually did not have the pleasure of actually seeing a Saturn V launch, and to have actually seen it is a privilege that I will always regret. And you got to touch history. And in this case, because it's such a powerful rocket, history touched you. And I wish I had been there. That's that much I can say.
Bob, as we look forward over the next several years, when do you really think, as Edgar Mitchell said, let's go to the moon first, let's reset our priorities and then go to Mars? When do you think we go back to the moon?
I think that there's going to be real effort to do space exploration, manned space exploration to the moon and beyond in the next decade. And I repeat, it's not necessarily going to be the United States. The ante keeps getting upped because more players keep getting introduced in the game. For example, in the last week or two, Britain, which has actually had a law in its books saying they will spend no money on manned space flight for almost four decades, maybe a little more than that, they are going to repeal that, and they're going to set up their own space agency because they feel they're being left behind. And so the game keeps getting more bigger, and the competition keeps growing. And so, yes, in the next decade, we will see space exploration. And once again, people say, let's go to Mars, but the moon is in the way. And the moon is a natural first place to go to learn how to get to Mars. And anyone who tries to bypass it is not going to be technically skilled enough when they try to go to Mars. And so it's inevitable. And in the next 6 months or so, we're going to find out some important things about the moon, whether there's water there or not.
Absolutely. And I think there is in some form or fashion. Thank you, Bob. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.